Hello, it's Monday, July the 12th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. We're going to be talking about why sexism should be treated like racism. Also, the son with an eating allergy, which helped a mum, a single mum, to earn millions of pounds. Social care, it's coming, but we're going to have to pay more taxes, aren't we, if it's going to be done properly. Why some of us will probably continue wearing masks in public. But first, we got so close, but in the end, so far, the dreaded curse of the penalties in England took the cup, which was supposed to be coming home, to Italy. So it all ended in heartbreak. England's bid to end their 55-year wait for a major trophy. Italy, of course, claimed the Euro 2021 crown at Wembley after winning 3-2 in what feels like the inevitable penalty shootout. The Prime Minister and Prince William and the Football Association have condemned the racist abuse directed at the three young black players who failed to score from the penalty spot. I'm joined now by a very downbeat Matt Gatwood, who's the Deputy Sports Editor of the Daily Mail. Matt, first of all, I'm not going to josh you about the fact your prediction was wrong because you thought we'd win. I thought we'd win, and I know nothing about football, but got to say it, with my limited experience as an observer, I thought the best team won.
Yeah, I did say on Friday when you asked my prediction that my heart said England, and that's what I went with. But I think probably deep down I was fearful. I did say my head possibly would go another way and proved to be right. Yeah, the best team won. England were poor, I thought, after a bright start. Certainly the second half, they were very poor. They couldn't get on the ball. They played very, very deep. They did exactly what they did in the last World Cup in the semi-final when they lost to Croatia. They took an early lead. They tried to sit on it, tried to defend it. Didn't play progressive enough football for higher up the pitch and ended up just sitting really deep. There were occasions where the defence had it and they just had to boot it long into touch because there was no out ball because we were sitting as a team collectively far too deep. And that ability to keep the ball and move the team up the pitch is something that other teams are better at than us. And until we close that gap, you know, we're not going to win these tournaments. Of course, we could have won it last night, but I don't think anyone in their right mind would say, watching that 120 minutes of football, that we were a better team than Italy.
No, I felt, as an outsider watching it, I thought we could have perhaps put two or three goals in the first 20 minutes. But the momentum stalled, they faltered. I wonder if nerves sets in.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the more times they get to these landmark occasions and they get to these semi-finals and finals of these major competitions, you know, the easier they're going to find it to win them. You've got to be like a team like Spain or Italy or Germany who constantly get to these stages of competitions. We haven't. So it is all very new for them. You know, maybe next time they won't be as nervous or as... Certainly the nerves seem to show in the penalty shootout. And maybe that won't happen the next time, you know, were we to get there. The more you do these things, then the easier it becomes. But yeah, I certainly thought it was a poor performance. And it started really with the team selection. Now, we all think Gareth Southgate's an absolute hero, and he has been superb. And I love the way he conducts himself and some of the things he's said about the team and the unifying force that the team have had on the country and that sort of thing. So I think he's an absolute star. Do I think he got his team selection right yesterday? It felt like a negative to go back to this back five. And then, of course, we score after 2 minutes. So you think, well, what a genius. But it felt like with that many defensive players on the pitch, we were inviting pressure onto us, which felt like what happened in the second half.
Everybody will talk endlessly, Matt, about the penalties. And Southgate very nobly said, I take responsibility. I chose them. That was always the plan. But why would you put an inexperienced 19-year-old... Bukayo Saka on that penalty spot, knowing if he missed, we've lost.
Well,
the pressure on that young man's shoulders, enormous.
Enormous pressure, yeah. I mean,
and was he one of the substitutes who came on just a minute or two before?
No, not Saka. That was Sancho and Rashford, who also both missed. They came on with a minute to go.
And they barely kicked the ball, so they hadn't even warmed up.
Well, they hadn't kicked a ball, no, but that is true. But if he'd brought them on, in Southgate's defence there, if he'd brought them on 5 minutes earlier, we would have had so many attackers on the pitch that if we'd then conceded a goal because we didn't have enough shape or balance of the team, he would have been criticised for why the heck have you thrown these guys on too early. So I think running up and striking a ball from a penalty spot, you don't need to have played 30 minutes football. So no. I think he can be excused that. And Saka, yeah, look, he's a young kid, and it was a huge amount of pressure on him to take the fifth penalty. So, you know, if you were asking me, would I have done that? Then I would have said no. I would have asked one of the more experienced players like Sterling or even Grealish, who's very a confident lad and who has today tweeted that he wanted to take one, but he wasn't selected to take one by Southgate. But they will have worked all this out. You know, they won't have just stumbled across it at full time last night. They won't have just gone, right, who's going to take the penalties? They will practice them, they will practice them, they will practice them, and they'll have a record of who is the best penalty taker, who are the top five penalty takers in the team. Yeah. And Saka must have been in that top five. And therefore, they'd have said, well, you've got a good record, you do it in practice. Now, of course, I know what you're going to say. Practice is one thing.
Absolutely what I was going to say. 67,500 people in the crowd. An audience of 30 million, 35 million, biggest television audience in this country ever, apparently.
Is a completely different
story. Different. And you'd have thought, as it was the fifth penalty and the one in which the whole tournament depended, you might have thought, I'm going to go for a more experienced person. Bearing, particularly as Southgate missed that penalty himself.
Yeah.
20-odd years ago.
When he took the sixth one. I mean, yeah, you're right. You know, it does fit. So maybe Harry Kane could have taken the fifth one. But then, of course, if sometimes the fifth penalty taker, you never get to the fifth penalty taker, because if the first four miss, and Harry Kane's standing there, who's our best penalty taker, and he doesn't get to take one. So they put Kane first to try and get us off to a good start. You know, so you can sort of look at it different ways. I do agree with you, though. Asking a kid that age to take that penalty, I wouldn't have done it. But as I say, they will have been through it. So, okay, he takes penalties in practice and he buries them all in the corner. How do you then say, well, how can you translate that to the pressure that he would have been under last night? And how do you know that someone 10 years older wouldn't have felt the pressure even worse?
Of course. But the goalkeeper being 6'5", you'd have thought perhaps here speaks a football knower. Wouldn't you try to boot it in the top corner rather than kicking it to the corner? Because that bloke could virtually filled that goal.
That's very true. The only hope you had was sending him the wrong way, really. Absolutely. Or like Kane, who got it right in the corner. So he Donnarumma, the Italian goalkeeper, guessed the right way for Kane's penalty, but Kane hit it hard and into the corner. The other guys who missed, apart from Rashford, who obviously hit the post, the other two, Sancho and Saka, they put it at the perfect height and it wasn't in the corner. Best penalty of the night was Harry Maguire, our centre-half, who actually drilled it into the top corner.
Brilliant penalty.
So, you know, I must admit, when Harry Maguire stepped forward, I was like, oh no, what's he doing with a centre-half taking a penalty? And then he puts it into the top corner. So I don't know. You could probably go round and round in circles and say, well, he should have taken it, he should have taken it. And, you know, of course, if Saka puts his in the top corner and we go on to win, then everyone says it's a genius decision to have him fifth.
And just finally, Matt, what's really deeply, deeply distressing about all of this, those three young men have been subjected to the most abhorrent racist abuse on social media. Prince William has condemned it. The Prime Minister has, the Football Association. It's deeply, deeply unacceptable. They were lionising these young men as heroes to get them to the final, but then they turn on them. Mocking their Caribbean, their African heritage, monkey emojis on their social websites. Disgraceful.
It's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And it is incredible that it's allowed to go on by the social media companies.
Yeah,
it's also incredible that someone would feel the need or want to do that sort of thing. But I'm afraid the England fans, or certain percentage of them yesterday, let themselves down from start of the day to the finish of the day, trying to storm into Wembley, of which many were successful in getting in, barging people out the way as they went, you know, causing absolute scenes of devastation and carnage in what should have been a celebration. But
and the Prime Minister wants to bring the World Cup to this country, a joint bid with Ireland in 2030. Yeah. That sort of behaviour, the fans and the racist abuse, will be broadcast all around the world.
And will have done them no favours at all. And, you know, you think, well, actually, then maybe they should be punished by not having any tournaments here if they can't behave properly when we host them.
There's something in that. Yeah. Just finally, Matt, I suppose we're all down in the dumps and fed up, but we did get to the final. It is the first time since 1966. So if we had this conversation at the beginning of the tournament, we might have thought we probably won't even get beyond the quarterfinals. We probably won't beat the dreaded Germany.
Yes, we would have said that overall, when you can, you know, it's hard to do that today on the, you know, with the pain of the penalty shootout still fresh. But overall, if you said we're going to get to a final and lose in the final, you'd have said, well, that's a pretty good effort now. But of course, you know, you just don't know. Okay, people are saying, well, we got to a semi-final last time, we got to a final this time, the next one we'll go on and win it because that's the logical progression. But who knows? The team may go backwards. You know, it's just impossible to say that we are definitely, you know, going to be more successful, or don't worry, we'll win the next one. one. You just don't know in football. It could come down to a dreaded penalty shootout. But the team do feel like they're on an upward curve. Yeah. They're getting better. They are improving. They are getting to the business end of major tournaments now, rather than going out to Iceland in the you know, in the knockout stages. So that is a positive. We can say that this team is on an upward curve. Let's hope it continues that way. Football's a funny thing, so you don't know that it will continue that way, but let's hope it does. And it does feel like hopefully we've got the right man at the helm, if he can just be a little bit more adventurous with some of these players as they get to the deeper stages of tournaments in the future.
Well, it's been great fun talking about it. A very disappointing outcome, but as I say, we did come second, and that's not a bad thing. And Matt Gatwood has been one of the great stars of the Euros for me.
Yeah, no one remembers the runners-up. No, that's true.
That's Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor at the Mail. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Prime Minister is confirming plans today to lift almost all legal restrictions on social contact in England on 19th of July, so-called Freedom Day. The Vaccines Minister, however, Nadeem Zahawi, says people in England should still wear masks in many indoor settings, even after the COVID rules are lifted. I'm joined now by Dr. Peter English, who's a retired consultant in communicable disease control, and he's a former chairman of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee. Dr. English, are you concerned that perhaps there are mixed messages coming out from the government over what we should and shouldn't be doing after July the 19th?
Absolutely. We've seen ministers saying in public that they will not wear masks when they're no longer legally obliged to do so. And then we're told that we're advised to wear them. So are these ministers who are saying that they won't wear masks if they're not legally obliged to, telling us that they won't follow the advice? And in any case, giving when you wear a mask, you're protecting other people.
Yes.
You might well be infectious without knowing it. Lots of people are. And if you're protecting other people, so your decision to wear a mask affects other people, not you. So it's the other people you might be harming. And if you're somebody who's vulnerable or at risk, it makes it unsafe to go out into places where there will be people who choose not to wear masks because it's their right not to do so, and they're no longer legally obliged to. It's catastrophic. We've got case rates which are increasing faster than exponentially. Exponentially means they double every so many days. But the period over which they're doubling has been increasing. We're expecting to see vast numbers of cases again, and even if only 5% of them need to be hospitalized, the hospitals are already creaking at the seams. There's no space for them. It's going to be a disaster.
And Nadeem Zahawi, the new health secretary, has warned that the number of infections could rise as high as to 100,000 a day, which will put even more pressure on the NHS. In your view, should the government just admit they've got this wrong about masks and say, we want you to wear them, you will wear them on public transport, if you go into a shop, and into enclosed spaces?
Yes. They might be able to do something at looking at how well ventilated spaces are and say that well ventilated spaces, particularly where people are all facing in the same direction. And I'm thinking of places like theatres here, where there's a lot of air per person, as compared to a tube train, where there's very little air per person and you can't help where you're facing. But so it might be possible to open up a little bit, allow some things that we're not allowing now. You might even consider it safe enough, although with the Delta variant, I'm not quite so sure anymore. But you might say that if people are fully vaccinated, it's safe for fully vaccinated people to meet each other unmasked. So in places where people are required to show that they are fully vaccinated, it might be okay to do away with masks. But otherwise, spaces like nightclubs or wherever, where there's very little space, a lot of people crowded together, are going to be places where super spreading events happen and lots of people get infected.
What's your advice to people listening to this, Doctor? Because the Prime Minister is saying caution is absolutely vital. Is your message carry on wearing masks?
Yes, particularly in crowded indoor spaces where there's not much air. If outdoors, it's probably not so much of an issue. If you're particularly vulnerable, wear an FFP2 or FFP3 mask. They're readily available. They give a bit more protection to the wearer. Masks are the other sorts of masks, less high quality masks, provide hardly any protection to the wearer. They're mostly about preventing the mask wearer from infecting others. But if you are vulnerable, get yourself an FFP2 or FFP3 mask to wear. It'll give you some protection.
And I heard the Health Minister, Edward Argar, today, I'm sure you heard him too, he was on the Today programme saying there would be clear and strong guidance despite legal obligations falling away, but people must make their own judgments on wearing a mask. He says he's going to wear one, but as you say, other ministers say they won't.
I think that's irresponsible. I think we have to tell people you must wear a mask to protect other people, because otherwise we know there are far too many people who won't take responsibility or they don't believe in it. I don't care if you believe in the virus or not. It exists. It will infect people. But there are people who are stupid enough to decide it doesn't exist. Hospital doctors find it incredibly frustrating. They're having people coming in and persuading patients, other patients on the hospital, not to get treatment for COVID-19 because COVID-19 doesn't exist. This is happening. There are crazy people out there. You can't rely on common sense to protect other people.
No, you're absolutely right. That's Dr. Peter English, who's a retired consultant in communicable disease control, and he was, of course, chairman of the BMA Public Health Medicine Committee. You can visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Taxes are inevitably going to have to rise to pay for a long-awaited new social care system. That's according to Sajid Javid. The new health secretary said that although he was instinctively in favour of low taxes, an increase to pay for care may end up being the practical and obvious solution. I'm joined now by Caroline Abrahams, who is the charity director at Age UK. Caroline, this has been a reform of social care has been promised by, I think, every Conservative Prime Minister since David Cameron. Boris Johnson promised on the steps of Number 10 Downing Street he'd deliver it. But we're nowhere near it even now, are we?
Well, I think we're probably not that far away from it, but it's interesting you raise the question of tax, of course, because it's widely believed that the thing that's held this up year after year is the question of how to fund it.
Yes. The Treasury has estimated wholesale reforms just to England's system could cost £10 billion a year. That's equivalent of 3p on the pound in income tax, something like that?
Well, I mean, you'll remember that the NHS was granted an extra £20 billion.
Yes.
As a result of it having a very special birthday a couple of years ago. And that didn't require a tax rise. So it isn't inevitable there has to be a tax rise. But I'm sure Mr. Javid's right. The worst thing from our point of view, the worst thing for older people would be some kind of half-baked, half-hearted reform that didn't cost very much and actually doesn't make very much difference to people. Because we know, we hear from lots and lots of older people all the time and their families. And where we are now, we just can't go on. It's absolutely not working. We do need to put a lot more money in. And so the question does arise, how are we going to get it together? And it may be Mr. Javid's right that it will require some kind of tax rise. Certainly, all of us, probably you, me and everyone else, are going to have to put their hands in their pockets one way or other.
Yeah. Now, we understand, we don't know, it's just what is leaked out of government, either intentionally or unintentionally, as a bit of kite flying by ministers, that the Prime Minister would want the scheme to pay for a cap on the lifetime costs of care to shield families from sky-high bills, because he wants to try to prevent people having to sell their home. Now, the talk from Number 10 is the cap would be set around 50,000. But the Treasury, of course, wants it to be a much higher figure to bring down the overall cost of the scheme. Now, you're in the thick of this debate, Caroline. Does Age UK have a view on should there be a cap, and B, what level would it be set at?
Yeah, we sure do have a view, as you might expect. Yes, our perspective is that if you're going to have the government's made it clear it wants to do a cap. It wouldn't have been the thing we started from at Age UK, but we absolutely see there's an issue there that needs tackling. It is the fact is if people, for example, have dementia and have to go into a care home for many years, gosh, the bills add up, and it can end up absolutely wiping out an average person's life savings. If they had a home they wanted to pass on to their children, that might have to be sold. And it's heartbreaking for people when that happens. So there is a real problem there. If the government's going to do that, then there's not much point setting it at 70 or 80,000, because very few people would ever get to it. And also, you know, I won't go into the boring technicalities, but actually it may not sound that high amount of money to spend, but the way it's calculated at the moment means in practice you'd end up as an ordinary person spending a lot more than that before you got any government help. So we're saying if you're going to do it, yeah, you've probably got to put it at a relatively lower level. So yeah, the Treasury shouldn't have its way over that. But the other thing we're saying, and I think is very widely agreed with across social care, is that just doing a cap won't be enough on its own. There's at least two other things government would have to fund as well. One is it's got to put more money into council's budget so that whether or not you're a homeowner, if you need care, there's a chance of getting a decent service. And then the second thing, absolutely linked to that, is that they've got to do something to strengthen the workforce, because at the moment there's loads and loads of vacancies. And quite often, even if you've got money to spend on care, there's no one to provide it. So, you know, that's no good either. So those three things together basically add up to $10 billion a year. That's where that number comes from.
If the government were to take that view and to pay more money to town halls, local authorities, would it be ring fenced so that the money is paid directly to help people with social care? Because the worry would be it would just disappear into a large local authority budget, and who knows what gets done with it.
Yes, I think a lot of people would agree with you, Andrew. You know, it's always a worry. It's supposed to be for social care, but it ends up filling potholes. So
yeah.
Yes, if people, particularly if people are going to be asked to spend more money, it seems only fair to us that they should absolutely get a guarantee that it will go to what they think it's going to. You could ring fence. You could have it's called a hypothecated fund for social care, or you could do something that was joint across health and social care. That's the other option that the government, I hope, will be looking at.
Currently, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, people have to pay the full cost of their care until their assets, including the value of their home, fall to just over £23,000. Well, that's nothing really, is it? £23,000
no,
in terms
exactly.
of what the average house is worth,
yeah.
What, about £300,000?
Yeah, and it's worse than that even, because actually they don't pay all of it until you get down to 14,000. Between 23 and 14, there's a complicated formula, which means you get a bit of help, but not very much. So, I mean, the rest of the world has moved on from this. Even the rest of the UK has got to a different place. Here we are in England. We're miles behind everyone else. And the end result is poor older people and their families are shouldering far too much of the burden.
And of course, we're getting older all the time. It sounds an obvious thing to say, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It means the demand for social care is going to rise. It's not just older people, too. It's also people of working age, disabled people, they use social care too. If you develop MS, for example, in midlife, then you might need social care as that illness sadly progresses. So, and there's more of those people too. So there's no running away from this. So lots of governments have tried to turn the other way and hope that the next lot can deal with it. But I think we've now got to the point, particularly after the pandemic, where we can't put this off anymore.
And we will remind him, of course, the Prime Minister, Caroline, you would have heard him say it 2 years ago on the steps of Downing Street, he would fix the social care system, his words, once and for all.
Exactly. And I think a lot of older people would say, well, a promise is a promise. If you're going to come out that clearly and say it, then jolly well ought to get on with it.
Quite right, too. That's Caroline Abraham. She's the Charity Director at Age UK. Thanks for joining us. So when her baby nearly died of an anaphylactic shock from a nut and dairy allergy, single mother Kirsty Henshaw was inspired to make her own meals free from gluten, wheat and dairy. First she sold them through health stores, but they are now so popular they're sold in supermarkets. She made 11 million in sales so far this year, has opened her own factory and is hoping to reach a turnover of £25 million. And Kirsty joins me now. So Kirsty, this extraordinary business you've set up, you launched it in, 2012. This year you've opened your own £2 million factory in the North Yorkshire countryside. You're hoping to hit an annual turnover of £25 million in a few years' time. And it's all down, really, to your lad Jacob in his eating allergies.
Yes, unfortunately he'll hear this and he'll want bigger pocket money now, I think. But yeah, he had an array of food allergies when he was little, and I was a young mum. I had him when I was 19, and it sort of threw me into a world that I didn't know anything about, really. But the market caters a lot better now, and we're sort of trying to lead the way in free from innovation, and our factory has opened up ample opportunities to go into different product ranges, and we've got our own site and sort of our own destiny, really, now that we've built
And you left school at 16. You came from a pretty basic, can I say that, council estate with very little money, and you never went to restaurants apart from a deep pan pizza for your dad's 30th birthday. So that's an extraordinary background for someone who's making a great success of food, healthy food, which is now being sold in some of our biggest supermarkets like Waitrose.
Yeah, so I mean, we could probably have afforded a McDonald's, but my family were very healthy. We've all been right. brought up vegetarian, and we grew up on lentils, and because it was cheap, really, we couldn't afford meat, so we didn't eat it. So I've had quite a good background and quite a good understanding in nutrition, but in terms of fine dining, I certainly didn't do that before the age of 30.
Right. And it all began, is it right, it all began with a coconut-based ice cream which you concocted using an ice cream maker which you bought in Argos?
I did. I bought a £30 Argos ice cream maker and made the first ever sort of vegan healthy ice cream for my little boy. And that was what I took on Dragon's Den and got investment off a couple of the dragons and bought them out 3 years later.
You're in, what, hundreds of health food shops. Tesco's have got you on board. I think the Dragon's Den boys gave you £65,000 of investment, but you've repaid that many times over, I would think.
Yeah, we bought those shares back in 2013, and I've worked sort of as an independent business ever since. We are sold in every major supermarket in the country. We're in about 5,000 or 6,000 stores. We don't actually supply health food shops anymore, just sort of the major multiples. And we're trying to be number one in chilled and frozen. That's our ambition as a business. And you know, we'll pull out all the stops, hopefully, and get there in a couple of years.
And you've developed, I think, 20 products across ready meals, pizzas and desserts. Sophie, where do you get, how did you know how to make this healthy food? Did you follow any recipe books, or are they all your own creations?
Yeah, they're pretty much mine. What we do is we take a standard product, such as a lasagna, and then make it healthy, make it free from. We use pulses, brown rice, things that you'd just use in your kitchen more than in a ready meal, and we try and bring that home-cooked feel to our products. So there's nothing majorly exciting about them. They're just classic products. For example, yeah. A cottage pie made healthier. Made with, you know, British beef and sweet potato mash rather than normal mash. So we just try and do little things to make a big difference, essentially.
And they're affordable as well, aren't they, Kirsty? Isn't that part of the success of Kirsty's? They are the average family can afford to buy your products.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're definitely not trying to be sort of an elitist brand or those only for London that can afford vegan, nice vegan products. We're very much a family brand. You'll find us in Asda, in Morrison's. You know, we're very much trying to cater for everyone that's got food allergies. And we're certainly not just catering for this sort of high-end market.
And how much of what is the ratio of your products that are exclusively vegan?
I'd say it is 40% vegan, 60% we've got meat. We're more focused on free from because that's the biggest market. Vegan's maybe the loudest, but it's not the biggest market. But we do naturally have vegan products because we don't use dairy. So they sort of fall into being vegan as well.
Okay, and which is the biggest selling range in Kirsty's?
Our ready meals, followed by pizza and desserts, is like a joint split. But our ready meals are what we make here in North Yorkshire. We've got an amazing team up here, and this is sort of the home of our business, whereas our pizzas are actually made in Italy, which we won't talk about today.
Yeah, I don't think we want to mention them, do we, at the moment?
No.
We're all a bit wounded about that. And how many people are working for you in the factory, Kirsty?
We've got just under 40 here in Harrogate.
Well done.
And then we've got, and for me, culture is the most important thing about business. I want everyone to be happy and come to work, and we pay well above minimum wage, and we just treat people as they should be treated.
And I think you say money's not everything. The thing that makes you happiest, it's your kids.
Yeah, mostly. They're sometimes a bit annoying, but generally speaking, it's family, you know, it's being with the children, just being in the outdoors. And yeah, money doesn't make you happy. It's about what you do with your life, isn't it? And what you enjoy outside of just working.
Well, good luck to you, Kirsty. I think you're a great success story. That's Kirsty Henshaw. You'll have seen her products in lots of supermarkets, Sainsbury's, Waitrose, Tesco's, called Kirsty's. And you know what, Kirsty? I'm going to buy your cottage pie because I love cottage pie.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm going to try it. That's Kirsty Henshaw. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.